My background is in the physics of disordered systems, amorphous materials, and so on. But recently, I got interested in some new problems where I think that the tools of physics, theoretical physics, can really shed some light. So I'm here to tell you about that. And I'm at Ryerson University in Toronto. Now, the basic motivation is coming largely from the study of biological systems. So in a lot of systems in biology, there are some sequences that we know encode some hidden structure. And we are often interested in what is the map from sequence to structure. So this is true, of course, of DNA in general, but it's also true at other levels. So for example, proteins are coded in a language of amino acids, and there's a huge interest in understanding what is the relationship between the sequence of amino acids and the 3D shape of the folded protein that you get afterwards. And one can ask, in the spirit of physics, are there some universal features of this sequence to structure map? So the big picture for me is that there are many people who are trying to synthesize the huge amount of data in biology and look for some general principles, look for some theory in biology. And we know that any such theory must include both information about what in physics we would call the microstates, so like the genotype in biological language, and the macrostate, which in biology they call the phenotypes. And we must keep track, theoretically, both of the genotypes and the phenotypes, because evolution is a feedback from the phenotypes back to the genotypes. So it's a bit of a daunting task, because it's like having a theory where you have both microstates and macrostates, and you can allow the macrostates to feed back onto the particular microstates that you're sampling. So it's not like, say, in condensed matter, where you have one unique ground state, which is some particular crystal state. Here, we have systems where there are a huge number of microstates, and they're very, very special because you can change any of the genes in DNA, and you can get a totally different organism or have organisms with different mutations and so on. So it's a daunting program, but I think that there's space there for physicists to make a contribution. So the idea that I'm going to take, the perspective I'm going to take, is to consider natural language, human language, as a kind of model system. Because the reason is that natural language has been studied by linguists for a very long time. We have knowledge of it both from the outside and also from the inside. So there's already some structures that have been put in place there by linguists and by computer scientists also. We can try to use. And when I mean a model system, I have in mind something like the harmonic oscillator, where starting from a humble mass spring system, the harmonic oscillator eventually becomes the basis for most of condensed matter and quantum field theory. So the goal is to find something that we can understand totally quantitatively under totally theoretical control, and then use it as a basis for more complicated problems. So why is it that language actually can be studied as something scientific and not just as a subset of the humanities? So the basic phenomenon is something that I think of as the rigidity of language, and it's encapsulated by these two sentences. So one, is John the man who is tall? To be compared with two, is John is the man who tall? Now, for anybody who's fluent in English, then you know immediately and with complete certainty that one of these sentences is grammatically correct, and the other one is not. So of course, one is grammatically correct and two is not. And notice that in order to make that judgment, you don't need to know who John is. You don't need to know in what context we would be asking whether somebody is tall or not. That's all irrelevant. Your judgment is just based on the logical structure of the words in that sentence. Now, it was Chomsky who tried to take these kinds of observations and use them as the basis for theory in language. So he has his famous sentences here that encapsulate that. Number three, colorless green ideas sleep furiously, to be compared with furiously sleep ideas green colorless. So again, three is grammatical. You can read it, you know how to pronounce it, whereas four is not even grammatical at all. So three is clearly still a meaningless sentence. And in fact, Chomsky came up with this particular one because any two adjacent words in this sentence never would go together normally, so you don't talk about things being colorless and green. Oh, no hockey stick. Oh, here. So one normally doesn't talk about things being colorless and green, but ideas being green, ideas sleeping, or something sleeping furiously. And yet, you can certainly read that sentence, know how to pronounce it, whereas number four is not even grammatical. So these sentences illustrate that there's something like logical structure of a sentence that we call syntax, which is distinct from semantics, which is loosely speaking the meaning or the connection to truth. So of course this is ill-defined, but you get the idea that there's the first basis of language, which is syntax, which has been studied by linguists and also computer scientists for a long time. So I should say that please interrupt me and ask questions if anything is unclear. So how does one actually formalize syntax? So the basic idea is something called formal grammar. So this was done by Chomsky in the 50s, extended to computer science by Backus a few years later. Although, in fact, there's a Sanskrit scholar, Padini, who was doing something similar for Sanskrit like more than 2,000 years ago. So the basic construction is what is called a grammar, or generative grammar. It's a set of string rewriting rules. So here and in the following, I have some asterisks, some footnotes where I have the more technical terms in the bottom, but I'm trying to use colloquial language in the talk. So the way it works is that we have two alphabets. We have hidden symbols and observable symbols. We always begin with the start symbol S, and then we repeatedly apply the rules in any order that we want until we have only observable symbols. So for example, this grammar has only three rules. Starting from S, we can repeatedly apply the rules in some order. We end up with this string AABBAB. So clearly this is equivalent to open bracket, close bracket, open, closed. And it's pretty easy to see that what this grammar actually produces is all the possible strings of well-formed parentheses. So it shows you at once that a simple grammar can produce first an infinite set of possible languages, and something that has a lot of structure. So in this case, the structure is relatively simple, just from these three rules. So in general, we say that the language is a set of observable strings. So the hidden symbols are like the logical structure that's hidden normally, and the observable string is what you get in the end. So what you can produce with formal grammars is very vast, and it depends what restrictions you have on the grammar. So there's something called the Chomsky hierarchy that classifies formal grammars. So there's, in the simplest case, the so-called regular grammars, then context-free, context-sensitive, and recursively enumerable grammars. And one way to classify these different grammars is to ask, if I have a string that was written in one of these grammars, what kind of computer do I need to be able to parse it, which means to build its derivation structure? So if you have a regular grammar, a string from that can be read by what computer scientists call the finite state automaton. So it means you take your sequence, you give it to your computer one symbol at a time. Every time it reads a symbol, it changes its internal state among one of finitely many states. Now, for the next most complicated class, the context-free class, you can also do it with an automaton, but now you need to have a memory, and that memory can be a stack. So remember, a stack is like a pile of plates. You can put as many plates as you want on it, but you can only read off the top. And then for the next most complicated class, context sensitive, you need an automaton, but now with the finite memory, but now the memory has to be addressable anywhere. And then for the most general class, you need to have, in principle, an infinite memory. So corresponding to these different classes of computers that you need to read the language, also there's corresponding different scalings of the complexity. So for a sequence of a certain length and a grammar of a certain size, how long does it take? What memory do you need to read it, and so on? So there are many things to do with this classification that are understood by the computer scientists. Now, that's a bit abstract, and another way to think about it is very graphical, which I think is more intuitive. And that's to look at the structure of derivations. So if you have a regular grammar, then the derivations are always linear. So this is the start symbol here. The ones up here are all the hidden symbols. And this is some derivation producing some string ACXYE. So it looks trivial, but actually these are used. So grep in Linux, the RE in grep stands for regular expression. It's basically what grep can read is something that is something formed by regular grammar. Regular grammars are also used in bioinformatics. So a hidden Markov model is a generalization of this to the probabilistic domain. And it's used in various biological applications. Now, the next most complicated class is the context-free class. And here, the structure is a tree. So this is a derivation producing from left to right, A, B, X, T, Y, T, X. And this was the class that were introduced by Chomsky for use for phrase structure. And they're also the class that are the most important for computer science. So what is the relation to computer science? Well, when you give your code to a compiler, what the compiler has to do is translate your code into machine language. And the natural construction for machine language is decision tree. So what the compiler is actually doing is building a derivation tree like this, which then gets coded basically directly into machine language. And so it's a bit of an approximation to say that, okay, the context-free class is what is used in compilers, but it's only a small extension beyond that what is used for real computer languages. Essentially because once you go to more complicated languages, then the computational complexity of parsing becomes too large, so it's not something that's feasible in practice. So it's often, you see in the literature that if you look at these more complicated grammars, one reads that you can't even present them graphically. So you can, but it takes more work. And what you get is something that is no longer a tree anymore. So you have some loops in the graph. And if you look, for example, at this here, where I have this A, B becoming a big B, then this is a manifestation of this rule that big A, little b can become big A, big B. And one way to think about this is that if you have a little b, it can become a big B, but only in the context where it has a big A on the left. So that's the origin of the name context-sensitive and context-free. Now, this is all very abstract, so what about natural languages? Well, as I already hinted, the relevant class are the context-free languages. So there are something like 7,000 existing languages. Only two of them have non-context-free features, so Swiss German and Bambara, which is a language from Mali. So when I learned about this, then for me it was very natural that, okay, this suggests that the ensemble of context-free languages is a natural ensemble for natural language syntax. Turns out to also be natural for computer science. Okay, and one can argue about what do you need to go beyond context-free and stuff like that, so we can discuss that a bit later. So how does it actually work? So here's an example sentence, the bear walked into the cave. The way it works is that the observable symbols are words, so one can further subdivide this into phonemes, but let's not go there. And the hidden symbols are abstract categories, so things like noun, determiner, noun phrase, prepositional phrase, and so on. And the basic idea, what does the tree capture? It captures the idea that if you have something like the cave, then this behaves like cave in the way that it can attach to other objects. So this is the basic hierarchical structure that is the basis of syntactic structure in essentially every language. Whereas if you look, say, at the next level, then into the cave behaves like into something in the way that it attaches to other objects. So one can further add extra tags on this to add extra features, but this is just the simplest case. So lest you think that it's all very simple, here's an example from a long Victorian sentence from Frankenstein, actually. The feelings of kindness and gentleness which I had entertained but a few moments before gave place to hellish rage and gnashing of teeth. And you see, okay, it gets a bit involved. It's still a tree, but it has extra tags corresponding to some subdivisions of the various categories. So what was interesting when I learned about all this was that, okay, language has a few basic principles. The first is the idea of composition, that we compose sentences out of fundamental units, which is so basic we don't think about it. But also, hierarchy seems to be really a fundamental property of language. And what was interesting to me was to try to find some model where you could understand this from the point of view of physics. So what do I mean by that? So we have this ensemble of all the languages in a given class, say the context-free class, what I'll talk about today. So this includes basically all the human languages, various computer languages, and so on. And these languages have been studied both by linguists and computer scientists since the 60s, but always from the strictly mathematical point of view, the very rigorous point of view. And as you know, if you deal with some very complicated set of objects, then usually what you can prove are statements about the best case and worst case scenario. So there are various theorems, and they essentially correspond to the borders of this space and in the different ways that you can quantify it. But the most interesting statement is actually, what does a typical member of this set behave like? And that's exactly the kind of question that we can use StatMech to answer. And surprisingly, nobody had really looked at this before. So in particular, it requires identifying what are the relevant axes in this huge space that will allow us to distinguish different grammars from one another, different languages from one another. So the suggested to me is the one should check out the investigate the StatMech of language, which I then proceeded to do. So the basic strategy has two parts. The first part is to quantify the grammar with weights. So it basically means to define an energy for these trees in such a way that the low energy trees are the grammatical ones. So that's then for any given grammar, then for any possible derivation, for any possible tree, it will assign some weight and energy that allows us to distinguish the grammatical ones from the rest. And then the second step is that then one wants to consider an ensemble of grammars. So we have to figure out what are the relevant dimensions in this space of grammars. And this will lead us to the notion of the temperature of a grammar. So this is the basic idea. So first, now a few technical details. So we can actually assume that the trees are binary. So it's pretty easy to see that if you had rules that were not binary, then by redefinition of some symbols, you could always make it binary. So what that means is that all of the rules would either be of the form that one hidden symbol becomes two hidden symbols, or one hidden symbol becomes an observable one. And the second key step is that so far I've been speaking as if the rules are strictly yes or no things, but in fact, it's convenient and more general to let the rules become conditional probabilities. So the basic objects that will be important then are one tensor, although there's no space here, MABC, which is the rule, the probability that hidden symbol A becomes hidden symbols B and C in that order. And for convenience, I'm going to condition on it becoming a hidden one. And then likewise, there's some object O for the edge of the tree. So in what follows, basically everything that happens in the interior of the tree, there will be some parallel for what happens at the surface of the tree. And now, so let me write sigma for the set of hidden symbols and O for the set of observables. Then the way that we define an energy is by summing over all the rules. This pi ABC just counts how many times that particular rule was used in some particular derivation. And I have it multiplied by the log of the weight, and then likewise something for the surface. And it's pretty easy to convince yourself that you can work out the probability of some entire derivation, some entire tree, just by starting at the root and working your way down with conditional probabilities. And what you'll get is exactly e to the minus this thing times some normalization constant. So this thing is what I'm going to be calling an energy in what follows. Now, there's a potential source of confusion here that these M and O's are probabilities for a fixed grammar, and then I want to consider an ensemble of grammars. So there will be two levels of probability. It's just like in the physics of disordered systems where you have some disorder, you fix that disorder, and then for a given disorder, you have all the configurations sampled thermally. And then usually what you want to do is look at then the average over the disorder. So you have, again, two sets of randomness. So, yeah. Yeah.
But it seems, what you described here, my understanding is that there could be many grammatical constructions that have different energies. Have I misunderstood that? That expression, like if I lay down a particular matrix O and M, everything I get out of that stochastic process is grammatical. And for different choices of M and O, I get different energies. So.
Yeah. So. The notion of grammaticality now is not something that's like zero or one. It's now something that where I have actually a probability for any given derivation. And if what we're going to find out is that if these M's and O's have a wide enough range, then very, very few configurations will actually end up having a small energy. So in principle, Yes, there's a whole, every possible derivation has some different energy, and many of them could have a low energy in principle. Okay, many of them will, because every possible sentence that you can think of in any given language will have some low energy, any grammatical sentence. But they will be sharply distinguished if the M's and O's have a wide enough variance. So does that make sense? Well, okay, let's just fix one language in particular. For any given language, the M's and the O's, if they have a wide enough range, then only the sentences we would consider as grammatical in the everyday sense will actually have a low energy. The rest will have very high energies. But there is a range. You could make it strict by having M's be infinite in some case and be in zero in other case, or one and zero or whatever, something like that. That would be the strict case.
Is there some intuitive notion? I guess I'm missing exactly what the variance of the M's and the O's correspond to here.
So we'll come to it later. In the end, the M's and the O's, they're just these probabilities. So say for English, if I have a noun phrase here, then there are some rules that a noun phrase can be composed of different things. So it can be composed of a determinant and a noun, or there are other possibilities. And in English, there are only finitely many possibilities that we would say have any real probability of occurring. So only some of the possible tuple, like A, B's, and C's will have some M that's, say, order one. And the rest will have some M that's very, very small.
So the idea would be something like this energy is kind of a proxy for how common this sort of sentence will appear in the language.
Yep.
Because there's things that are grammatical that just very rarely
said
because they're very unlikely.
Yep. Okay, so all of that was then for one fixed grammar. I can specify all these probabilities, but then one wants to look at the ensemble of grammar, so then one needs a measure on the grammars themselves. So the basic intuition for what this measure should be is that these objects M and O, they're acting multiplicatively. If we think of however these M's and O's evolved, the simplest type of process is that something happened and some particular rule got a greater probability and some other rule got a smaller probability. And if many such independent processes occurred, it's going to multiplicatively change all the M's and O's. If those are sufficiently independent, then you'll get a log normal, just like the log of the central limit theorem, basically. So the simplest model that we can think of is where the M's and the O's have a log normal distribution. So what that means is that the important quantities to characterize a given grammar are what I call here sparsity. So basically, the summing the log squared of all the MABC or all the OAB here. So you see that if all the MABC are equal to M bar, this sparsity is going to be zero. As I tune the different rules away from this uniform limit, then the sparsity increases. And a log normal distribution is just when I have the distribution of these M's and O's being e to the minus this sparsity times some Lagrange multiplier, which we're going to identify as a temperature. So I'll call it here epsilon d, the deep temperature for what happens in the interior of the trees. And then there's everything happening at the surface basically in parallel. And it's easy to see that if I look at the mean over grammars, then the mean of the sparsity goes inversely with the temperature. So when the temperature is very high, the sparsity is low, and vice versa. And this basically corresponds to our intuitive notions of what happens with disordered systems, as I'll get to in a second. So what is the intuition? So if I think of just what's happening for one particular branching of a tree here, if I have some particular symbol here, say some sigma A alpha 1, then the idea is that when this temperature is large, there are many possibilities that what it can branch into. It's a bit like a particle in a landscape with many minima where it has a lot of energy, so it can end up in any one of these minima. Whereas once the temperature is low, then there are only very few possibilities for what it can become. So the basic idea is that the hot regime is when it's highly variable what you get with the grammar, whereas the cold regime is when it's very, very deterministic. So this is like the the role of temperature in disordered systems when you have many metastable states. So what actually happens in this model? So first, let me show you some numerical results. So I'm going to fix what's happening at the surface of the tree, and let's look at what happens as we change the parameters corresponding to the interior. So N here is the number of hidden symbols, and epsilon D is the temperature. I'm going to show you the results from something like 25,000 different languages sampled from this distribution. And what I'm showing you here are Shannon entropy. So the Shannon entropy measures how far some distribution is from being a uniform one. And the key result is that when the temperature is high enough, then this Shannon entropy actually takes its value corresponding to pure random noise. So this particular Shannon entropy is for, it's for the hidden symbols. So it's specified in detail here. K here is, these are called block entropies. So K equals 1 means we're looking at the distribution of single hidden symbols, looking at its entropy. K equals 2 is looking at pairs of hidden symbols, adjacent hidden symbols, and so on. So this, with this normalization, when K goes to infinity, this converges to the asymptotic entropy rate of the entire process. So this is a bit complicated, but the main point is really that above some critical temperature, this is equal to 1 in this normalization, which means we're just producing noise. Whereas below some temperature, it starts to drop precipitously. So it means this transition is really the emergence of structure in the language, when we start to produce no longer random noise, but sequences with actual structure. And if you look at the similar Shannon entropy, but for the observable symbols, so this is what you'd actually measure for sequences, then what you see is similar, but a bit less dramatic. So again, it's flat above above the same temperature, and then starts to drop below that. Now, there are error bars on these plots. The error bars are not the errors in the measurements, which are much smaller. The error bars show you the variation over different grammars at the same parameter settings. So the idea is that suppose we just measure entropies of some sequences that we get out in the world, then if we look at the right quantities where the error bars are small, so-called self-averaging quantities in the jargon of disordered systems, then just by measuring those quantities, we can actually infer what the relevant parameters are. So those are the important quantities. So it looks like the entropy in the limit where k goes to infinity, which is the entropy of the whole process, is such a self-averaging quantity, which means that we've really identified what are the relevant dimensions in this space that actually control at least this most basic property, the entropy of the sequences. So the key is that there's the emergence of deep structure at some characteristic temperature that scales in some way with n that's not very important. Now, one way to get a bit more intuition of what's going on is to look at what can be called a zipf plot. So if we look at the distribution of single hidden symbols and now rank them in decreasing order, so the symbol that occurs most frequently is number 1, the symbol that occurs next most frequently is number 2, and so on, then what you see is that at high temperature, this thing is flat, so you're basically using all the symbols equally with equal probability. And below some characteristic temperature, which is the temperature of this transition, then this starts to have some structure. So there's some symbols that you use much more than others. So what it's telling you is that what's happening is that there's a permutation symmetry that's spontaneously broken at this transition here. So above this transition, it's like you have all these symbols, but they don't really mean anything because they're just labels and you're using them interchangeably. But once you go below this transition, then they start to have their own meanings because they're not used with the same probability. So it actually matters that this particular symbol, like noun, only gets decomposed into these other particular symbols and so on. And in fact, you can understand the placement of this transition from balancing energy and entropy. So basic idea is that above this transition, the variations in the energies of the different possible derivations are small enough that entropy just wins and you just produce random noise. Whereas as you go below this transition, then some particular derivations have have a low enough energy that wins over entropy, and you just sample the ones that have the low energy. So just like in a standard phase transition, you have this type of transition. Now, if this is really a symmetry-breaking transition, then there should be some order parameter that measures the order that's created at the transition, and one can actually define such an order parameter. So it's what I call here Q2, and it's the idea of this is basically the same as the what's called the Edwards-Anderson order parameter from Stinglasses. So the intuition is to think of just the single branching of the tree and ask whether for a given symbol, it branches into all the other possibilities uniformly or not. And this measures the extent to which it's not uniform, that branching. And so it's very close to zero above this transition and then rises in some characteristic way. And again, these error bars are showing you the variation over the different grammars, showing that this quantity is largely a function of these things that we've identified. So, what's the good of all this? So, I think that it can shed some light into how a child learns syntax. So, people have been thinking about this for a long time, and there's a scenario that's there in the literature called the principles and parameters theory. So, the basic problem is that we know that a child from anywhere on Earth can learn like any human language in the right environment, but we don't expect that the child has some catalog of 7,000 languages in their brain. So, how is it that the child comes to learn the very precise syntax of one particular language in some environment? Because we know that the information that they get from parents is quite small, it's very noisy, it's not very organized. So how does it happen? So the basic idea of the principles and parameters theory is that the child is endowed with some principles of grammar, and that syntax is controlled by some parameters. So for example, whether verbs come before objects in a particular language or vice versa. So in English, that's one way, in Japanese, it's another way, and so on. And the idea is that if it's possible to categorize all the syntax of all the human languages by some small enough number of parameters, then the amount of information that the child actually needs to learn from its environment is greatly reduced. So it's quite attractive because it reduces the problem of learning syntax to learning setting some small number of parameters. But the basic problem is that the linguists have been pursuing this idea. They find that if they really want to capture the variety of human languages, they seem to need many, many parameters, or that the parameter system does not work exactly perfectly to categorize the different languages. So then, if you need, say, 100 parameters that need to be set, then you don't really retain the parsimony of the original theory, and it's not really clear if this is the right approach. So I think that this kind of model can shed some light on this, because the basic idea is to think about learning as like an energy descent in this space of grammars, because initially the child doesn't know anything, so it's just babbling away. It's like not knowing what any of these rules are. So it starts with them all at uniform value, which is like being this high temperature regime. And now, as long as what it's doing during learning is trying to match its parents' output in some way by tuning the weights, whatever it does, it's going to be lowering its value in this, its energy in this space. So it's like descending in temperature. And at some point, it's going to hit this transition where then energy starts to win over entropy, and it starts to learn. It learns some particular structure. Now, there are two important things here. So first, in this idea, then the parameters would be like symmetry-breaking transitions. And what I've studied that I showed you is like the ideal case without any field, where everything's totally isotropic in this space of parameters, so there's just one transition. But now you can imagine that if I'm doing this learning in an environment, it's like energy descent with a field, where you're going to break this permutation symmetry. And so instead of having one transition, you can have many transitions, where you're setting some subgroup of the permutation group. And then each of these transitions could be like setting one of these parameters. And the key point for me is that all these transitions would then be emergent properties of the model. So it's not that the child has to know in detail all of these specific parameters that it's setting. Once it has the basic setup that it's learning this type of model, then the rest is just the physics of this model that's all emergent from the model. So in particular, it would mean that if one could derive the phase diagram of this model or some similar model, then one could map out the syntax of, say, the context-free languages for the model that I presented. And then one could use that, compare it with the data, the empirical data on how the different languages are related, and try to falsify the model and proceed from there. So I think that's quite attractive, and it allows you to retain this type of theory even if there are apparently many, many parameters that need to be set, even if syntax actually is a very, very rich a structure. So that motivates then, okay, what I would like to do is actually solve the model, basically meaning computing some partition function. So what would that actually look like? So the energy, if you look at the terms in the energy, it's like log of m evaluated at these different points, where each of these alphas is one branching of the tree. So sigma alpha 1 is like is the hidden symbol above here, alpha 2 is here, and so on. Now, this looks a bit like spin models that we know how to deal with. So maybe here you guys know about the SYK model, where you have some similar interactions, where you have JIJK or IJKL or so on. So I spent 5 years in Paris, and in the environment that I was in there, people were talking a lot about P-SYN models and stuff like this, which are actually related to SYK models that are studied in relation to glasses. Now, the key difference between the type of model we're dealing with here and these type of models is that, see here, I, J, and K refer to sites. For each site, you have some fixed value of the interaction, J, I, J, K. The difference here is that we have like sigma I, sigma J, sigma K. So the sigmas are on the sites, but then the value of the interaction you have to get by indexing in, taking the hidden values, hidden states, sigma I, sigma J, sigma K, indexing them into some object M. So it's this iterated indexing that's the real difference between this class of models that corresponds to grammar and models that we know how to deal with that have been studied for a long time. So I think there's a whole universe of models where this, with this essential difference, where there's new physics waiting to be discovered that are related to things like what I told you about. Now, one can write down the partition function that would allow you to compute this thing. And in this original representation, it's very hard to work with. I tried various standard techniques that don't really work. And eventually what I realized is that there was a better way to do it, which is not to work with this direct representation, which is complicated basically because you have a tree structure, so you have this complicated topology that has to be explicitly taken into account. The better way is to write down some model where the Feynman diagrams of that model generate the trees that you want with the right weights. So this technique I learned from some paper of Kazakov, and it's there here and there in the literature, though not used very often. But it works very well. So the idea is that if I take, say, this sentence that I have shown you before, I want to make this the Feynman diagram of some model. So I basically want to generate planar rooted trees. And you know, generating trees with the field theory is very easy, actually. If I want to make them rooted, then the best way to do it is to have a complex variable where the non-zero propagator just attaches some variable with its complex conjugate. And to make it planar, actually, I can just, in this case, just use L and R left and right variables. I don't need to do anything complicated with matrices. And the complication is that this diagram is going to have some weight that involves all the corresponding M's and O's that are some fixed values that are like playing the role of disorder. So that's the real complication with this type of theory. So a little bit more explicitly, what does it look like? So this is the Gaussian part of the model where you have the propagator. And then as an interaction, we have sources for the roots, sources for the leaves, and the interaction vertices here. And then what we want to do is we want to extract some class of trees with, say, M trees with L leaves total. And we can do this with some contour integral. So, okay, using some basic properties of trees, you can do it just by doing a few contour integrals. And then the key is that since we have disorder, in this case, the grammar, what we know from the physics of disordered systems is that the right thing to average is the thing that's like the free energy, the log of z. And to average the log of z, you can use what's called the replica trick, where you basically use this identity, which allows you to work with z to the n. So you have n replicas of the original model, where eventually n has to be analytically continued to zero. So that's the basic idea. So what do you get? So skipping all the details, here's what you get for this order parameter Q2. So this is now on log-log axes, so it's showing you the part where this was small and starting to emerge. So this plateau down here is like a finite sampling effect, so that's something that's not important. And so ignoring that, what you see is that the theoretical results, so this is in a certain ansatz that I'll explain in a second, that it works quantitatively below, basically below this transition, sorry, above the transition, and it fails below. So what is this ansatz that I use? So it's what's called in the jargon replica symmetric. It basically means that you ignore the presence of metastable states. So if you ignore the metastable states, then you can solve the model and you get this that works here, but it doesn't work in the ordered phase, which is totally expected because what it means is that once you're in the ordered phase, all the different languages that you have are all distinguished from one another. So you have to know whether you're working with German or English or so on. And you cannot, in the theory, you must take into account the fact that you have all these different possible languages. And it's so far, it's a challenge to actually get any results for the ordered phase. So, okay, that's more or less where I am. And really, there's a whole world of things that can be done with this type of model. There's many, many related models. So going straight on from what I've been talking about already, one would like to derive the phase diagram of some class of languages, for example, context-free languages. If one could do it with fields and one could map out this phase diagram, and then one would like to be able to place human languages in this phase diagram. So with the current status of natural language processing, the machine learning models can basically extract, they can basically learn human syntax. So they're learning something like this object MABC and the O's, although it's not in that explicit form. But I think that one could bootstrap the models that are being used to extract this information. And then one could just place those languages in this phase diagram and see where they end up. Now, the formalism that I talked about with context-free languages, if you talk to a linguist, they might start talking in another language of what are called merge grammars. So basically the idea of merge grammar is to retain the basic idea that you're building trees, but in this class of grammars, what the vertices are based more on conservation principles rather than having some explicit interaction with the quenched weight. So it's a bit different, but one can play the same game and look at the same type of thing, a class of merge grammars, and see what happens, which would be very interesting. And then going back to the various biophysical problems, are there some languages that parse, say, proteins and so on? And I shouldn't give you the impression that syntax is everything, so semantics is also very, very important. And one example that I like from a book of Steven Pinker is just trying to think of how many steps it takes you to understand who he is in this dialogue where Alice says, I'm leaving you, and Bob says, who is he? So if you think of how many steps you need, then you're using a lot of your knowledge about the world to make sense of that, and that's going totally beyond syntax that I've been talking about today. So is there some physical approach to semantics? This takes us kind of into the realm of logic, so there's a whole mess there. There's not really an accepted formalism in the same way that generative grammar is accepted for syntax. So with that, I would like to conclude that a lot of complex systems have some generative aspect, and there are big problems there that have to do with building theory for biology, in my opinion. One can consider natural language as a kind of model system because there is already some formalism there, and one can look at, say, context-free grammars as a model for these properties. Then if you have taken an ensemble of grammars, this leads you to a random language model, which has what we would call a glass transition. And what I think is important is that the StatMech problem, it's not trivial, so there's something to learn there, but it's also not completely intractable. So there's definitely room for related models where one could actually maybe discover totally new physical phenomena. So I'll end with this somewhat provocative statement that mathematical linguistics have been around for a long time, but I think it's time for a physical approach. And I would like to thank some of my former colleagues in Paris, Remy Monesson, Jorge Kirchhoff, Francesco Zamponi, Guillaume Semergian, also Pier Francesco Urbani, and Giorgio Parisi in Rome. Thank you.
We are reading languages to be kind of static, and this reality that we have right now, but it's sort of removable. So my question is if there is, if this sort of approach is friendly to introducing maybe changes over time to language, and if we can model how a sentence would change over time or predict maybe changes to language.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. So Murray Gell-Mann got interested in language evolution near the end of his life, and so I read some of his work on the topic, and he was saying that if you look at the data, then what you find is that the lexicon, the vocabulary, is much more conserved when languages evolve than the syntax. So with the syntax, it's more like once you exit some basin, then the language rearranges, and it's something that's quite distinct. So just looking at the syntax, it's more constrained, and you don't seem to learn as much as when, if you're trying to learn, look at the evolution of language, they get more data looking at the lexicon, just because you have more arbitrary degrees of freedom there that can be conserved unless there's some force making them change.
I was very interested in so this idea of a phase transition, maybe can be extended on if you add time as a variable of a phase transition on when a change is becoming permanent to the language instead of just a fluctuation.
Yeah. There are people who study things like this about when a word changes its meaning in a language.
Right.
And there are some kind of characteristic curves about the onset of the word changing its meaning and things like this. So some of this is being studied, definitely. Yeah.
And another question, unrelated. I don't know, so we're assuming that we know our Hebrew variables, and we're assuming that we know the rules, and we're moving forward. Mm. Can we do it backwards? And if so, how much information do we need? Because there are many languages on which we have very limited amount of information on how the language used to work, for example. So maybe we can feed that to a machine and use the model backwards to learn more about it.
Yeah. So the inference problem where you are given some data and try to learn the language is very, very interesting. And actually, I started looking at that, and then it was a bit hard to know what was going on, so it was easier to just simulate the forward problem and then work back. So you can basically, you can pose similar types of questions for the inverse problem, and there are computations that have been done. So for example, what you can do is, one thing theoretically you can do is to, okay, of course you can do machine learning things where you have some more or less black box algorithm trying to minimize some energy and trying to learn. But things you can do, say analytically, is you can fix some sentences and you can ask, what is the volume and phase space of grammars for which these are grammatical? And this is called a Gardner computation. It was done for neural networks in the 80s, and you can do similar things here. And there's also a transition there where you find imagine that we receive a signal from outer space of some length, L, of some alien language, and we ask whether the sequence is long enough to learn the language. So you can imagine that if L is small, there's going to be some enormous number of languages for which it's grammatical. Whereas as you increase it, then it's more and more constrained. And at least in some simplified model, there's actually a transition at some characteristic L where then typically the number of languages for which it's grammatical drops to one or so above some order one threshold. So okay, one can play similar games there, and then there are many, many, many things to look at that haven't been looked at.
The last one, if you don't mind. So you mentioned a few times of this idea of a description of all human language, but I don't have much background in linguistics, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I thought there was a little debate on whether the different languages actually come from the same one or from the same group, or if they're even related at all. So how much does your description reduce if you take, for example, just the Romance languages? Mm-hmm. The parameters that you need are decreased significantly?
Yes, it's debated whether or not all the languages have some common root historically.
Yeah.
But it's not that much debated that all languages have a common structure. So they could have a common structure just because we have the same hardware. If that's the main constraint and not the history, then that's enough to have a common structure. What does the map of human languages look like? So if you look in the linguistics literature, then okay, there's all sorts of things there, and I can't give you any kind of simple characterization. So definitely there are some languages that are studied more than others, like the Roman languages, but There are other ones that are studied because they're very different. So, okay, Japanese is often studied because it's quite different from English. But also there are ones like Navajo in the US and I don't know, various things, Mohawk, that are studied just because they're very, very different. And yet they're still totally legitimate languages with full structure where you can still express everything.
Yeah, I think my question was more on the realm of, okay, if you just restrict yourself to the study of maybe only Romance languages, if the amount of parameters that you need be a lot less than maybe.
So yes, I don't really know. Well, this stuff is not really known from both if you ask the linguists or if you ask like a physicist or something. So these things are debated, and if you go into the linguistics literature, you can, read forever about various subtleties. And it's, you don't know exactly when to draw the line of what is a distinction you would consider as valid or not. And this is what's debated in that literature.
Any other questions?
Okay. Right, so the basic construction that can break context freeness is if you have like what in English is a respectively construction, where we can say that A, B, and C went to X, Y, and Z respectively. Now, in English, you can't syntactically link A with X and B with Y and C with Z. So it's still context free, but you can imagine that if you could syntactically link A with X, B with Y and C with Z, then you wouldn't be able to represent it as a tree anymore because you'd have to have some crossings when you try to represent it. So apparently in Swiss German, this is the kind of thing that where you can do it, because you can attach pronouns to the verbs or to the nouns in such a way that you cannot represent it as a tree anymore. So this is the basic idea. Yeah. Are there any Swiss German speakers?
Generate the languages? Did you choose particular rules for the languages? And did you make sure that the rules make sense?
So they're just sampled according to this distribution. So they would be considered nonsense languages from compared to real.
But would it be a nonsensical grammar that, for example, you have some hidden symbols that can never be reached? Or did you
So there are certain pathological behaviors that can happen. Most of those only happen if you go to very low temperature. Because
did you need to exclude that somehow? Or did you, starting how the system behaves, did you sample it differently? Or is it nothing to worry about?
So there is one thing that I kind of hit under the carpet that I basically conditioned on the tree before I placed the symbols, which is a bit unnatural. Normally what you do is you would think of building the tree organically. And then there's a possibility that you build an infinite tree, that it never stops. Now, okay, so there's some subtlety there that may cause some complications. So basically, it's like I'm conditioning on the size of the tree, because in realistic languages, the trees, they have some definite, not definite size, but some range of characteristic sizes. And certainly there are things there to be studied that could be important or not, I don't know.
Characterized against a backdrop of sort of a general problem of how to understand the way children pick up language. So I know Chomsky, for example, would say that they don't have enough evidence really to learn grammar as a problem. And you sort of mentioned people suggesting that there are too many parameters to learn in most of their models. It seems to me though that given the progress we saw in machine learning in the last 10 years or so, a lot of those criticisms seem not realistic anymore. So if the way we classify images is anything like the way neural networks now classify images, a deep neural network has many, many parameters that it has to learn, right? So it's no problem learning 100 parameters. That's easy. So if we're doing that for image classification, we could be doing it for classifying sentences as grammatical or not. And then furthermore, that we have unsupervised learning. So we don't need somebody telling us what's grammatical and what's not. We can just try to recreate what we've seen as grammatical examples and do pretty well. Mm. And now we have these generative adversarial networks where we can produce things. So given all that, is it really valid anymore to say that linguistics has a problem?
Well, the basic
models? I just wonder.
So the basic problem is that the neural networks are given enormous amounts of data, much more than when we consider that, let's say, children have, at least with respect to language. With respect to images, I don't know. But it's generally considered that you cannot really compare the way that machines are learning various tasks with the way that humans are. Now, I think the key point is the second thing of what you said, that if you look at unsupervised learning, then we start to see in machine learning, that they can do much better or as good as they were doing with supervised learning, but with fewer examples, where they're just trying to find structure. So my approach is more like that. If you're trying to lower your energy, it's like an unsupervised learning task where you're just trying to find the structure, which is finding the M in this case, which is like unsupervised learning. They're trying to maximize some likelihood function. It's the same as minimizing an energy. So my approach is more like that, where yes, you're just trying to do something like unsupervised learning. So I think people in linguistics, they don't think that machine learning is changing their views, I think that I'm trying to strike something intermediate, because in machine learning, what you can take away from the successes there is that if you want to learn something, you have to have continuous variables so that you can do something like energy descent. Whereas in linguistics, people were trying to learn things with discrete variables, and it doesn't work. You just get stuck all the time. And I think that's really a key insight that was learned from the machine learning community, to work with like continuous variables and doing gradual learning. And so that's why I phrased the whole model in terms of an energy where I have continuous variables. So although I'm talking about things that eventually, once you learn something, it's something that should be very strict, what this is grammatical or not. But you actually learn it in a continuous way, and then once you just go deep enough into some well, then all your probabilities are sufficiently distinguished that it's as if you know something precise or not. So I'm kind of trying to build a bridge between the two communities, actually.
Any more questions? Okay,
thanks.